Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, Hollywood manager Barry Katz tells a story about how he helped Tracy Morgan get on Saturday Night Live by turning no's into yeses.
And we made a decision who we feel is the least likely to have a shot at getting Saturday Night Live, and we're going to remove them from the showcase. And unfortunately, that's one of your artists. You can't do this. Please don't do this. We've been working so hard. It's just an extra 5 minutes. Who is the person? Tracy Morgan.
Don't miss this incredible and inspirational story by Barry Katz about perseverance, tenacity, and how to turn no's into yeses today on Storyworthy. Stay close.
Hey, it's Barry Katz, and you're listening to a great podcast, Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. I'm so glad you guys tuned in today. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the story last week with Phil Rosenthal. Phil, obviously, like one of the nicest guys in the world. And his series, which used to be called I'll Have What Phil's Having, is now different. Now it's called, and maybe you don't even know this, I'm going to tell you right now, Barry Katz, it's called Someone Feed Phil. And it's on Netflix. So this is very exciting. It's a brand new announcement. The show is just starting now in January on Netflix. We're in January, so I can tell you that.
I love Phil Rosenthal.
So do I. And if you guys haven't heard Phil on Storyworthy yet, please go back and listen to that. But not right now, because today I am here and I am honored to be with the one and only Barry Katz, who's been on the show before.
Isn't that true of everybody? Isn't everybody the one and only?
No, not really. A lot
I'd
are
like to
just
introduce
like,
the three and maybe.
Yeah, it's just some comic I know. I say that all the time. I am thrilled to be with you once again, Barry. You always have a good story, and you know today I know will be no exception. Today your topic is turning no's into yeses, and you know that's kind of like your catchphrase. If anybody listens to your show Industry Standard, they've heard you say that again and again. So it's, you know, and obviously it makes sense, turning no's into yeses. But you know, I want to hear your story. But also, you know, I think about it. I think like, that's true, except for, it, like, at least in this town, it's not that big of a town. And you can't, you know, like, if somebody says no, you can't then, like, go and, like, stalk them. I mean, there has to be, like, a, hey, man, we said no. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you have to change tact, or maybe you have to change your format or what you're doing and, you know, get the audience that is for you, no matter what the field, whether it's in music or acting or comedy, which... You know, so I've heard you talk a lot about comedians, but I don't know, I think like there is pushing it and there's determination and there's trying to get what you want. And then there's also, you know, I'm anxious to hear from you. When do you have to say, okay, hey, we said no, and you have to listen. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
There's got to be a point.
There's definitely a point, but I think that the whole part of it is you got to look at yourself. You got to put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're going after and think to yourself all the times in your life what it is that happened that made you change your mind, all the different times that were significant. And then if you can put yourself in that situation, normally it's really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And also, change is generally always good.
Absolutely. I mean, look... You've heard many expressions. I'm sure your parents said it's always darkest before the dawn. I was in, of all places, one of my favorite places in Starbucks in Malibu, where I happened to have been able to get Caitlyn Jenner to do the show. And I was there late at night before I went home just to get a cup of tea. And I'm the only one in the place.
Is this at Cross Creek?
No, this is the one farther up by Trancas and Broad Beach.
Yeah.
And so I'm there, and I'm the only one there, and a woman comes in that I notice has been there many times before. She's an older woman, probably, you know, between, I'd say between 65 and 75. She's not one of the young students in there. She's older. And she sits down next to me and she starts talking to me and she says about what she's doing and what she wants to do. And I said, what's the thing, you know, that you're doing that you're really excited about? She says, I've written 14 screenplays.
Wow.
And I looked at her, and I'm the most positive person in the world. And I looked at her and I said, I will never write 14 screenplays in my life. I will never be able to do that. I don't think I have it in me. And I was so excited for her. And as I was leaving, she said, do you live around here? I said, yeah, I live here. And I said, where do you live? And she said, in my car.
Wow. Wow.
And I said, well, when's the last time you lived in a place you could call your own, where you had your own key and it was your own apartment or home? And she said, 30 years ago.
Wow. That's stunning.
Now, none of these screenplays have been produced. None of them have been made. But the persistence in keeping going and believing in yourself. And she wasn't mentally ill. She wasn't, you know, she was just like you or I.
And I think that's beautiful, though, in all facets of life, not just in entertainment. You know, just that people keep going. Like, I play tennis with a guy named Tony on Wednesdays, and he's 85, and he still takes lessons. He takes tennis lessons.
Incredible.
Do you know what I mean? Like, he's trying to get better.
You know what you don't get an 85-year-old guy for Christmas?
Wait. Oh, I know. A hope chest?
A calendar.
You're such a jerk, man. Green bananas.
I am old. What are
you're
talking
bad.
About?
You're bad. Hey, listen, I got to tell you, you mentioned Caitlyn Jenner. She was recently on your show, Industry Standard, but not just her interview. The next interview you did with Lorraine Newman, I thought was specifically good. And Lorraine Newman gave you a compliment, which I thought, this is an amazing compliment. I would love to get this compliment someday. She said to you, she thanked you at the very end, and she said that she liked the way you framed her trajectory. And she said it was very satisfying.
Oh, that's, you know, the thing about this crazy business, and I sit across from you, and I'm a very comfortable person, and I feel very confident, but when you say that, like, something happens to me, and I feel, like, very, very...
Are you flush?
Flush and humbled, because I think it's natural for most of us in this business to kind of look at our careers and our lives like an anorexic looks in the mirror when they say they're fat. You know, I know my place. I know why I'm here with you. And to have Phil Rosenthal be an episode right before me, the guy is just one of the most amazing, extraordinary men out there. And to know that I'm actually, I mean, I'm like, I feel like I should be wearing clown shoes next to Phil Rosenthal, when, you know, but yet I get to hang out with him. I spend time with him at his house, and I'm just blown away by that. And so when I'm here with you and I hear that about Lorraine Newman, it hits me in a way where I almost feel a little bit of anxiety and uncomfortability, because I want to be that person. I want to make that impact. I want to make her feel comfortable. She said no probably 20 times to me, which leads into what we're going to talk about. And I just kept trying and kept trying. And then she finally said yes. And the fact that after she did it, she was proud of it and how I looked at her career, because she looks at her career, again, like I'm talking about, she doesn't really have an understanding. She doesn't think, she knows she's a great artist, but she doesn't feel like she's as great as she is.
Yeah, but I also think that she's been interviewed a lot. And every time she's interviewed, people ask her the same three questions, and she's over it. She doesn't want to talk about it Saturday Night Live. And so then you interview her, and you start talking about her work as a mime in France. And I did not know that about her. I had no idea. And I am a huge fan of her sister, Tracy Newman, and Tracy Newman has been on Storyworthy. And but Lorraine has also turned me down like three times. But Tracy has done it, and I'm a huge fan of hers. And I was really interested when you started asking Lorraine about, you know, growing up with a sister who's a folk singer. And you know how Lorraine sort of like, you know, she kind of turned against that. Or, you know, that wasn't her scene.
And that's what I try to do on the podcast. Like with Caitlyn Jenner, obviously, I could talk about the Olympics. I could talk about, you know, everything having to do with that. I could talk about Kim Kardashian, Kanye West, the Ryan Seacrest who produces the show, the Kardashians. I just felt like, I mean, everybody does that. So I just wanted to talk about her story.
I would like to, here's what I would ask Caitlyn if I were to meet her, is what does she do for exercise and does she still run? Does she run?
I think she said on the podcast that she, the main sport that she loves playing is golf.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're a runner, I mean, at the level that she was,
oh yeah,
you just don't run anymore. I mean, it just seems like that's kind of a sport that you do your whole life.
It's so hard to believe that, as Bruce, she was a great runner because she's tall. She's taller than me, and she's probably as big as me, and that's big. You know, because I'm like
it's a lot to run with, you mean.
And I've never known, I don't know, maybe I'm not in the business of running, but normally the best runners, the ones who win the marathons and the ones who do really well are
very light.
They're light and they're very, you know, petite kind of guys. And so that really surprises me how great she was as Bruce and in that kind of.
Yeah, I'm thinking of his physique at that time. He wasn't heavy at all.
No.
You know, so he was light, but he was still tall.
And when I'm around her, she doesn't feel like she's that much different than his size. But I don't know. Maybe it's just my perspective.
Yeah, I think she's very beautiful. And it's exciting that she's accomplished what she has and getting, you know, she's taken on so much heat for everybody else to feel normal. You know, so it's really exciting.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that shocks you, too, because you think that people... Everybody thinks that money is the key to making you happy. Everybody thinks, if I just had this money, I'd be able to take care of this. When she was Bruce, she was making $6,000 a year training for the Olympics. $6,000. Plus room and board.
Mm-hmm.
But $6,000 for, I think, 7 years. And now, obviously, she's a multimillionaire. And she was a millionaire... as Bruce, before that, doing the stories and the corporate gigs and everything like that, and was never really happy. And when somebody looks across from you at 67 years old, who's your height, and, you know, you're looking them eye to eye as a woman, and they're saying, I'm the happiest
that
I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, to find peace like that.
It's incredible, because I don't think, you know, I sit across from you, and I know you, I don't know you that well. But I know you're not at peace. I know that I'm not at peace. I know that I have the wheel, the hamster wheel in my head.
Yeah, constantly.
Every day I'm sitting across from you and I'm prepared to do this great thing with you and I'm excited about it. But the wheel is turning. The wheel is not turning about the story that I'm going to tell.
No, I know.
The wheel is turning about what's happening next, what's going to go here, what's doing that. Because for me, like when you are around people like that woman at Starbucks, that really takes your breath away, because you're sitting across from somebody who is more prolific than you, is smarter than you, has more drive than you do in that area, yet they've been living in their car and they still don't give up. And that's just blows you away, because every day as an artist, I don't care who you are, there's something that happens that makes you want to give up, makes you want to just pack it in. And you talk about all those things about how these people are. Caitlyn Jenner, three of the people that she respected the most and who always praised her the most, Bob Costas, Frank DeFord, and it escapes me the name of the transgender activist who she respected so much, all came after her hard when she came out.
Yeah.
And so you still can't. I always say life and business is like a whack-a-mole game. Like when you're a kid, you knock the mole down.
Something's
you're like, I
come
did
up
it.
Somewhere
and
over there. Absolutely. I believe that for sure. All right, let's get to your story here. But before we do get to Barry's story, I wanted to remind you guys to head over to storyworthypodcast.com and just see what's going on over there. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to spell it, because you hear that, right? Storyworthypodcast.com. Da-da-da-da-da. Like, you understand what I'm saying. So go there and look at the snazzy pictures. Why not? There's something to do. Oh, and guess what? There's a mailing list. Do you do a mailing list, Barry?
I do not do a mailing list.
You know what? And also, I'd like to talk about your web presence, but we can save it.
I have a problem with my... People don't know this about me, but I started social media for artists with Dane Cook, where he engaged me with his talent and mine to create social media, which hadn't been done for an artist, to the point where a couple of years later, we were pressing a button and selling out two shows at Madison Square Garden. Yet for myself, for some reason, here I am on this therapy couch here in my office, I don't have the drive or the emotional wherewithal to promote myself. I'm a manager. I'm a producer. Yeah. I do film, TV.
Well, you don't have to. You just have to hire somebody to get a few things in line.
But even then, I think I feel awkward about it, because I'm like, what am I going to promote myself? I'm not an artist. I'm like,
no, but it's just a calling card. It's just sort of like, if you don't have a web presence, that says as much about what's going on than if you do. So you may as well just put it out there, because people are gonna find out anyway. So you may as well put out what you want. I'll cut all this out. Don't worry about it.
No, but that's, you don't have to cut it out, because I think it's important for people. And I think that's one of the most miraculous things about the podcast I do, is that things have gone fairly well without me really doing anything.
So can you imagine if you had a presence, like in terms of like BarryKatz.com or Industry Standard or whatever, and then from there, you know, now we start shooting out, there's books, there's tapes, there's web conferences, you don't know.
No, I love this. Will you manage me?
That's what I'm talking about, man. All right, look, you guys, listen, don't forget to subscribe to Storyworthy. That's important as well, over at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or NPR One or iHeartRadio, wherever you're listening. That's not what's important. What's important is that you subscribe wherever you're listening, right? Because then you're supporting me, and then, you know, you and I, we go back and forth, and, you know, it's good. Works out. Barry Katz is here right now, you guys. He's a film producer, a comedy manager, and a very nice guy. Now, look, Barry, as you guys know, is universally known for introducing Hollywood to some of the most extraordinary comedy artists in the business, including Dave Chappelle, Jay Moore, Anthony Clarke, Bill Burr, Wanda Sykes, Whitney Cummings, Nick Swartzen, Dane Cook, like you said, and Tracy Morgan. Now, he's also the executive producer of the film I Killed JFK and The Road Trick, and also the movie Hood Pranks, the movie. Yeah? Hood Pranks?
Yeah, that's going to be coming out soon.
That's 2018.
Also, Misery Loves Comedy with Tom Hanks and Amy Schumer and Judd Apatow.
Fabulous. Misery Loves Comedy. Oh, that's going to be good. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like...
I'm sure we will all be busy the day it comes out and the day it leaves the theaters.
Oh, come on now. I'm excited. That sounds good. What a cast. I mean, Amy Schumer, that's amazing. Judd Apatow, yeah?
Yeah, it was a cool documentary. It's a... You can catch it on ViewMaster, probably.
Well, I'll just show it to your mom. We'll see it anyway. All right, you guys, listen. I'm cutting that out. All right, like I said, Barry has a podcast called Industry Standard, and I'm telling you, it truly is a one-of-a-kind weekly inspirational podcast that features an insider's look at Hollywood from a totally different perspective. Now, like we were talking about, you feature all kind of celebrities and really interesting people, and they talk about some really honest stuff with you, you know, about their successes, but also a lot of their failures. And that is fascinating for people like me or anybody who is, you know, trying to accomplish something in this town and get ahead, to listen to other people and what they've gone through. It really helps. At least it does me. You've interviewed people like Gary Marshall, Judd Apatow, who you just mentioned, Norman Lear, Rita Rutner, and so many others. And I tell you, I never miss it. So, besides subscribing to Storyworthy, you guys, you should subscribe to Industry Standard. I'm just saying.
And that really, again, really strikes me when I sit across from you, the fact that you listen. And I just, again, you know.
I'm sorry, what?
It's so hard to really believe, but it's, you know, you mention things about it, and obviously, so I'm very grateful.
You guys can find Barry over on Twitter, at Barry Katz, and soon to his new website, BarryKatz.com. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for the one and only Barry Katz.
All right, so the story about turning no's into yeses involves a client of mine that I represented for about 5 or 6 years, Tracy Morgan, and Saturday Night Live, and the perseverance and what it takes to figure things out. The story I'm going to tell you is more on my side than the artist's side, but it still is a fascinating story, and I think your audience will enjoy it. So, as a manager, again, I don't know why I did the things I did, but I felt comfortable going up to Harlem and watching comedy in Harlem. I used to say to the comedians up there, I felt like a line of cocaine on a black album cover. I was like the only white guy there, and we had this amazing camaraderie, even though I grew up in a town, Longmeadow, Massachusetts, that was, I don't even think there was an African-American family who lived in the town, and it was like 15,000 people. So I don't know what brought me up there, why that was. You know, I could think back to when I cried open a file cabinet with my dad's old albums after he passed away, and there were all African-American artists in there except for 3 comedy albums with white artists. One of them being Bob Newhart was an inspiration to me. So, but I'd go up to Harlem and I'd see the comics there, and I would see Tracy Morgan, and he was this heavy-set, incredible physical performer that would do all these physical gags and would kill. Didn't really have that much material, but really blew me away. And I went up to him, and he said he was managed already by somebody from that area. And I always tell him, listen, if ever there was a time in your life that you need to talk, or things aren't working well, or you had a conversation with that person and you decide to stop working with them, I'd love to meet with you and talk to you because I think you're amazing. And so I'm in my office. I had an office at 57th and Broadway.
Wow.
And he just comes into the office space one day without a call or anything like that, goes into my office and sits down, and he's wearing like old Converse sneakers, white socks that were very dirty. It looked like he'd been working under his car for the last 3 days. He was wearing cargo shorts that were really, really dirty. He was wearing a white t-shirt. You know when somebody wears a white t-shirt so many times that it's not white anymore? Yeah. It's like you'd explained holding up the thing to the, it's just a different color. It was like a gray with holes in it. He had that kind of hair that, you know, I don't even know, was like a misshapen afro that hadn't been taken care of in a long time. And he was wearing a beanie on his head with the green patches and the different colors with a propeller coming out of it. And he sits down and he closes the door. He says, "Yo, B, I got to talk to you, man." I said, "Hi, Tracy. I didn't know you were coming." "I know, man. I know you didn't know, but I'm here. I got to tell you something, man. I'm not working with my manager anymore. And, yo, B, I'm living in the projects. My kids are in danger every day. You know, there's gunshots. There's gangs. I got 4 people living in a little apartment with my boo," which I guess was the girl he was with at the time. "And I don't know what to do. I got nothing. Will you help me? Can you help me?" And I said, "I'd be honored to help you." And the first thing I did was I took all the footage that he had, because he'd done a couple of guest sets on Martin, where he played a character called Hustle Man. And I put a few things together, and I went to the networks to try to get a short-term, a very rare thing, a short-term development deal between January 1st and May 1st, where a network could have somebody for that pilot season, and they wouldn't have to compete with anybody else.
Wow.
So he needed money right away. He needed a situation right away. So I sent this tape to people. I said, "Listen, this guy's brilliant. You can have him for pilot season exclusively, and I don't need a lot of money. I'm not looking for a lot of money. And I did a deal with the WB after getting a no from everybody else in town. And the WB gave me a deal for $60,000 for him for pilot season. And with the option that he could turn down three things. So I'd been in a situation where I'd been turned down by the other networks, but finally got one to say yes. And they were amazing, that network. He didn't end up doing anything for them, but he got the money. And he was able to move his family out of that apartment into a high-rise apartment, I believe, on the water. And he was really happy about it, really excited about it. And so the next thing was, I knew they were looking at people for Saturday Night Live. And I had a great relationship with them because I had like two people already on the show or three. And I called them and I sent them a tape of him that I put together, that I edited together, and I'd done this for other artists. And they agreed to test him for Saturday Night Live at the comic strip. And there were 16 people going on. I had seven artists who were testing. He was one of the seven. So I had done this formula with a lot of people, and it worked. But something happened that I didn't expect to happen, that never happened before. And I'd never been in a situation where I had to deal with it. So I'm working with Tracy. There was an office next to mine that was open. A tenant left. And I was training with him because he was nervous. Because when I told him I got him a test for SNL, the first thing he said to me was, I don't know if I can do that. I said, what are you talking about? He said, it's at the comic strip, right? I said, yeah, it's going to be great. It's wonderful. That's where Eddie started. He said, yo, B, I don't know how to tell you this, but I ain't never worked in front of a white audience before. Never. I said, don't worry, I will help you. And we worked on the set, and it was like I was customado with Tyson in that office. We would run the set over and over again, over and over again. And then when we go to the clubs and test it out and try it out. But it was only 2 weeks before the test. But we were working on it. It was working great. And then the thing happened that blew me away. I get a call 2 days before the test. Barry, Lauren, and Marcy from Saturday Night Live are on the phone for you. I pick up the phone. It's Marcy talking. I presume Lauren's listening, but he isn't speaking. She says, Barry, thank you so much. Lauren and I are so happy. You've really done a great job. You have so many people testing. We're so grateful. But Lauren, he feels that 16 people are too many people to have on a show, and he'd like to take one person off the show. And we've gone over this list over and over again, gone over the tapes over and over again. And we made a decision who we feel is the least likely to have a shot at getting Saturday Night Live. And we're going to remove them from the showcase. And unfortunately, that's one of your artists. I said, you can't do this. Please don't do this. We've been working so hard. It's just an extra 5 minutes. Who is the person? Tracy Morgan. That's the person that we feel has the least chance of getting the show. Wow. And I'm like, you can't do this, Marcy. Please, please. We'll have them go on anything. 5 minutes. She said, I'm sorry, Barry. It's not going to happen. We've made our decision. And she hung up. Now, at that point, I have a few choices. I can call the artist, Tracy, and say, listen, it's not going to happen. Or I can pack it in and myself and say, I'm not going to fight this. Or I can figure out a way to strategically get to them so they will change their no into yes. And that's what I did. I did not call Tracy. I made the decision not to call him and keep preparing with him, even though I knew that it might not happen. Because in my mind, I thought, I can fix this. Back then, there's no email. There's no texting. There's nothing. All there is messengers, faxes, FedExes, and phone calls. And I am calling every hour. I am messengering that day, that night. I'm typing on one of those typewriters that you have to put the white out in when you make a mistake because I don't have a computer that's spitting this stuff out. This is before that time. I mean, some people had them. I didn't have them. So I'm calling. I put a FedEx together with the letter. I'm messengering. I'm doing everything I can. No one's answering. No one's responding.
No, what are you saying?
I'm saying in the letter, pleading with them, please, I guarantee you that he will exceed all of your expectations. I know that you guys have the highest expectations, and I promise you, I will not let you down. And he will get the show. He can get the show. Just trust me. I haven't let you down yet. Trust me. But I wasn't like a big person. Like I wasn't like at the time. I didn't have the cred that Three Arts or Brillstein had. I was just a guy with a ponytail and cowboy boots and jeans. But I had the eye. And so I kept doing that. Kept calling every hour. Leaving messages. Calling. Messengering. Faxing. And it was like about noon or 1 p.m. on the day of the test, maybe 2 p.m. Supposed to be there at 7 o'clock at the comic strip. I call again. I've called 5 times that morning. Marcy Klein picks up. I said, Marcy, hi, it's Barry. I know it's you, Barry. I know it's you. I am tired. I am sick and tired of you calling over and over again. This is Saturday Night Live. We are a respected place of business. And I'm like, Marcy, just hear me out. Just hear me out. And she's like, Barry, shut up. I said, Marcy, please, let me just tell you what I wanted to say. Barry, stop. I said, Marcy, please, I just want to tell you. Barry, shut up. And I stopped talking. And she says, he's on the show. Don't ever call back here again. And she hung up. And I still didn't tell Tracy. Kept preparing that afternoon. Went to the test with the 16 people. He crushed. And he was the only person from that showcase that got Saturday Night Live.
Okay, so what was his position on the show out of the 16?
They put him number 3.
Number 3. Interesting.
I don't know why.
Did you talk with him later? Did you tell him the story later?
After the contract was signed for Saturday Night Live, I told him. And he told me that if I had told him, he never would have been psychologically ready to do it. He would have thought that they didn't want him.
Did Marcy then thank you?
Marcy has always been great to me, and she's always been thankful to me. Do I remember if she thanked me specifically then for pushing? I don't remember if she did or not, but to me, her saying yes was the greatest thank you for her and Lauren that I could ever get. I don't need to, and I'm sure she did, but I don't need that verbal recognition.
Right, all you don't need the credit for it.
No, although when Tracy wrote his book, he told me that he was writing something about that story, and he wrote about it, and that made me feel good.
That's really nice.
He acknowledged it.
Yeah. And so do you think at that point you ever thought, like, there was one of the other 6 clients that you were representing that you could have maybe given up their spot? Or would you have fought for every single one of those 7 clients that you had in the showcase?
I never would have given up anybody else's spot that they earned to get it. I had to fight for his. And believe it or not, there were people on that lineup that I had testing. You know, it's not like children where, you know, you have your children. Who's your favorite? I don't have a favorite. They're all my favorites. In every instance, you know instinctively who has the best shot of getting something and who doesn't have the best shot of getting. Now, if you were to tell me that Dave Koechner, who created 6 original characters his first year on the show, would be fired and Tracy Morgan, who didn't get, I don't think, anything on the show his first year. His biggest segment was a weekend update where he showed how he was featured in the show, and it showed him waving goodnight at different shows. I would have bet anything that Dave Koechner would have been on the show as long as Tracy, and Tracy might not have made the cut after that first year because he wasn't getting on. But that wasn't the case. But in any lineup, you have an idea of who has the best shot to do something and who doesn't.
Okay, so but that's why I'm asking you then. Were there the other, you had seven people on that show and you thought Tracy had the best shot?
Yes.
So did you ever think to say to Marcy, okay, listen, you know, if I have to get rid of one of my seven, can it not be Tracy? I mean, did you consider, I'm not saying you wanted to throw anybody else under the bus, but were you thinking that?
In my mind, that was never an option. I would never take away the opportunity that somebody works so hard for. And have the power, and I did have the power to do that.
You have
a
lot of integrity.
And I wouldn't have done
that. I'm impressed. I really am.
I couldn't imagine doing that to somebody. That would be, like, horrible. I had to fight for him and for getting him on, and I hope in that case it worked, and the turning the no's and the yes's worked. I just want to share with your audience, we're not brain surgeons. Brain surgeon can't mess up. Everything has to be a yes. Every operation has to be a yes. If he makes one mistake, he's out of a job. You know, for a manager or any situation in life, whatever job you're in and turning the no's and the yeses, I don't want you to think like, you know, it's possible to turn every no into a yes. But this is a story that just shows you one of the most difficult situations where I had no power. Again, normally when you're trying to turn a no into a yes, you have very little power, and they have all the power. So the key is, how do you figure out how to get them to say yes and still have them look at you like you have no power? It's my decision that I made.
Yeah, it's just a very fine line, because I also don't want to harass people. And I think now, like when I ask people to be judges on my game show and stuff like that specifically, I try to get celebrity judges. You know, if I don't hear back from them, that's kind of it. I mean, I might email them two or three times, but I don't think it would be appropriate to call them or to, you know, in a way harass them. I mean,
well, you just turned a no into a yes, because I think I said no last time, and now I'm saying yes if you want me again.
Will you really? Do you want to do it December 30th?
If I'm not on vacation, but
here we go.
No, but it's okay. The holiday.
No, listen,
look at me. I'm going to do the show.
I know. You told me before you will, and I want you to. I do. Okay. It's a great game show, and you'd make a wonderful judge. Let me ask you something. When you say you're working with Tracy Morgan, and you're working all day, and you're working on his set, are you talking about he's running the material in front of you, you're sitting on a couch, and he's running it to you, and you're saying, slow down, pause here, speed it up? What are
yes,
you talking about?
No audience, me in a room with him. He's doing the set over and over again. Now, I know what you're saying. Barry, that's crazy.
No, I'm not.
Comic would ever do that in front of their manager? Every circumstance is different, and people need that, and they don't need that. Look, I worked with Melissa Villaseñor for 8 years, who's on SNL right now. When she tested for SNL, it was unbelievable how much preparation we did together. It was incredible, so positive, and her audition was so strong that Lorne did something that he rarely does. He got up from his seat when she was walking off the stage of testing, and he shook her hand and he said, nice job. That doesn't happen in those tests. But I knew in my heart that her resume was empty. There was nothing on her resume. So Lorne would probably be looking at it and saying, is this a fluke? And I had the feeling he was going to ask her to test again. And he did. He's very shrewd and smart. And it's like Tracy Chapman's first album. It's like you play it until you can't play it anymore.
New beginning.
But then the second album,
oh,
Isn't it the one with Fast Car?
Fast Car was the first one, and then New Beginning was the second one.
And the second album didn't do as well, because, you know, who could follow up 10 years of work to get the first album out, and then you got to pump one out in a year?
That's very common with bands, especially.
Yeah, and it's the same in comedy tests. She had to come up with another, a whole different test.
Three characters or something.
More than that, like probably five or six.
Wow.
And so it didn't do as well. She didn't get the show. And each time tried to get on the show, she couldn't get a test, couldn't get an audition until about a year and a half ago, which was another probably 6 or 7 years after the last time she tested. She didn't give up. She kept trying to turn that no into a yes, and now she's on the show. And it just shows you, you just got to keep going.
So there's two different timelines going on. There's like an immediate timeline, bugging somebody to get, like you had to bug Marcy. You bugged her, and that was kind of in the immediate. And then there's kind of a long-term, you can't give up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course.
It's all about the unspoken thing that people don't talk about is control. We're happiest when we're the most in control, and we're the least happy when we have the least amount of control. Now, a religious person might say, no, Barry, that's not true. It's we're happiest when we control our perspective on the environment, and we have control over our perspective. Mm-hmm. I believe it's just a general control thing. So, for instance, like, if you own a house in real estate, you own a house, you're like, I own a house, I paid for it, I'm paying the mortgage, I'm in control, no one can take this away from me. What did you say, the sewage system broke down? It's $40,000? what do you mean the pool has a crack? What do you mean we need new wiring? But then you say to yourself, ah, fuck this, I'm not going to own a house anymore, I'm going to rent. And then you rent a beautiful house and you're really excited and everything's happy. You got two bills, your electric bill and the rent. You're like, hey, this is simple. This is great. What do you mean you're getting the divorce and you need to sell the house? What do you mean the person died who owned the house and they got it? So there's
life
always
changes.
Something that...
There's always going to be something that you are having difficulty with. But if you're saying, if you believe in yourself and you can understand that you're, if you say you love acting or you say you love podcasting, then just do that in terms of being with it all the time. Live it. You know, you can't say, I want to be a good tennis player and not watch other tennis players. You know, kind of like you just have to work on it all the time. It has to be part of your being.
Yeah, and that's the thing about these podcasts that's, you know... Look, I do. We're here at lunchtime, and I'll normally interview a guest at lunchtime, and I'll edit on Sundays. And hopefully my sons won't be in therapy saying, oh, Daddy didn't spend enough time with me. He was editing his podcast on Sunday. But, you know, I have a business. I couldn't be able to – I'd never make it if I did the podcast during those times. I have to figure out how to do it. I even do radio on KOLS. I'm sorry – K-Rock. Is it K-Rock? Yes. Editing. I do interviews on K-Rock every Sunday at midnight. I drive to Culver City.
Right on, man. That's
every
great.
Sunday at midnight. Because I want to be on that show. I want to help people know about it, and I want to make an impact to those listeners if I can. It's weird. I wouldn't do it if it were on a, you know, I wouldn't do it if it were during the day or what, it wouldn't make sense for me. But if I
could people ask me that frequently, you know, how I do what I do and not get paid for certain, you know, whether it's going out doing storytelling or podcasting or why would I do that? And yeah, it all adds up. I do a free workshop on storytelling on Sundays and people say, why do you do a free workshop? Because I want to be in all of it. Yeah, I totally get that. But two things. Is there anybody now that you're trying to get a yes that has been telling you no on industry standard on your show?
Oh, of course.
Well, who do you want really bad right now?
a person who I really would love to have, and I'm going to mention a name, and you'll be like, I don't know, does anybody going to really understand or know, is Irving Azoff.
Oh, sure.
Because
oh,
I've
sure.
known Irving my whole career.
Really?
And he's an incredibly extraordinary man. I've hung out with him at many different events. I've
wow.
been to his house.
Wow.
But it's the funniest thing. Like, this is the weirdest thing about certain things. So I'll ask Irving to do it. I've probably asked him 20 times. He said yes 20 times. And then the next day or the next hour, 2 hours later, you get the call from his publicist. I told you, don't bother Irving.
Wow.
He can't do it. He's too busy. I'm
Why
like, well,
you...
he told me yes.
Yeah.
He doesn't know his schedule. You can't call him like that. You call me.
What if you take your equipment with you and just sometime if you get to hang out with them, you know, take a beer over, a bottle of wine or something, and then just whip out the Zoom mic and record it?
Well, it's something that I know I'm going to get him.
You
I
will.
Know it's going to happen.
Will. Yeah.
Like another guy I worked on for a long time that said yes is Chuck Lorre, and I'm just working out the date. But it's hard when you got a guy who has 17 shows on the air.
Yeah,
to find
he'd be.
The right
an, I would like
date.
To hear that. I would like to hear that interview
but
very
he's
much.
He's been really supportive, and he that's something. And I just want to say one thing about the story-worthy thing, because the reason why I love this so much is that. If people don't realize it already, the story, if you're a young kid, if you're older, whatever it is, the story is the most important thing. It defines what a successful song is or book or a comedy routine. Or even if you're a guy who goes on a first date and you don't have a great story, guess what, pal? You're going home alone, and you're not getting a second date.
But do you think it's always the story, or is it the way the story is told?
Well, you know, 50% is the story, and it's like a stand-up comedy routine. There's many different comedians who you see. You know how you see the comedian who just stands there and has no presence at all?
Right.
But his material is insanely
right.
great.
Right.
Then there's the guys who are dancing all over the stage, and they're killing... but they don't have any material at all. And then there's the people who have both. You know, the people who can, like a Cat Williams, who has phenomenal material and moves and uses the stage, or a Chris Rock, or a Jim Jefferies.
Yeah.
You know, these people are like, you know, they have both combined. The trouble with comedy, well, I don't want to say the trouble with comedy. There's no trouble with comedy.
Oh, there's a lot of trouble.
The thing about comedy that's so odd is, like, in most professions, you can find people, many, many people who are brilliant in mm-hmm. their fields. But in comedy, as your listeners would do this, try to name how many people are geniuses in stand-up comedy and see if you can get past one hand. And that's the thing that's fascinating. We're at the height of the comedy in this country and probably the world, yet there's probably five or less people who you would consider to be a genius.
Well, let me ask you about Louis C.K. You represented him from the age of 18 to 26.
My first client ever.
And he, many people would say, is a genius. And do you think he has any career ahead of him at this point?
I think everybody has a career ahead of them. Everybody.
Well, Bill Cosby doesn't.
Well, Bill Cosby is 85 years old.
No, but I'm saying even though he was never convicted, wouldn't you say as of 10 years ago, or what was it, 7 years ago that we've been talking about him, his life is kind of over?
I think his life is over because you can tell it's like, you know, he's winding down. It's like Joe Paterno. Joe Paterno was involved in that situation, and it was later on in his life. You have very little time to fight back and take your career back and try to be a better person. If this happened to Cosby, let's just say it happened to Cosby and he settles out with all these people or whatever. And again, as I'm talking, please know in your audience, I'm not saying that anything that happened in these situations is right or proper. We're just talking about whether they have a chance to come back. So if Cosby was like 30 or 35 or 40 and he'd had a show on for 8 years, he would be able to figure out a way to do some kind of service to the community if he wanted to help contribute to a cause that he feels he misused or
perhaps I don't know. I just think about Louis C.K. and I just, you know, it's so shocking, and there's so many stories, and I don't see how it's, I mean, I guess it's just so, still very current.
I'll tell you why nothing shocks me.
Nothing shocks me either, but I just don't see how it's going to pan out for him.
I'll give you an example, and this could be edited out, it might not be. You're a woman in this business. When you walk out of the house, I presume you walk out of the house saying, I'm going to fuck these people up today. I'm going to go out in this world, and I know that I can take a room. And when I say take a room, that means you can walk in a room and people turn and say, who's that? It's a great feeling as a man or a woman. I would like to think sometime in your life, I would presume at some point some man did something in front of you in the realm of what Louis C.K. did. But they're not a successful showrunner, producer. But they did it. If you were to talk to 100 women and ask them if they know of any woman in their life, including themselves, that has not been subject to some sort of abuse, either mentally, socially, or sexually, what would it be, 1% of 1%? Do you know anybody in your life that hasn't been?
No, so I don't know anybody.
This has been going on since Fatty Arbuckle. So the reason why I'm saying this is that for Louis, you know, time normally heals things. And if he takes a stance, let's just say he says, for the next 2 years, I'm going to work on female-driven projects with female producers, writers, and to get those shows going. And that's, I'm going to dedicate my time to that because I made mistakes and I want to make sure that I can do whatever I can in this business. I know I can't rectify the mistakes. I know I can't change how those 5 people feel about me, but maybe I can look at my mistakes and help millions of people, inspire them to be better. There's a lot of people out there, I don't have to tell you this, if there was a true serum in your veins and we were in a soundproof booth and you could say something about yourself that you've done that you don't want anybody to know about, you would have at least one story.
Right. Okay, but here's the thing. Here's what I want to say. When it comes to sexual proclivities, if like you are a pedophilia, if you're a pedophile, then you can only get off by young children. If you masturbate in front of women, it's not about the sex, it's about the power. And if that's how you get off, then that's how you get off. Like, in other words, I don't know if that can be changed. How can you change, like, if somebody's a homosexual, you can't say, no, I don't want you to get off that way anymore. I think you should change it and get off this way. Like, I think when it comes to sex, I don't think that it can necessarily change.
I believe that anything's possible. I'm not saying that it's possible for everybody, but I'm sure Louis is evaluating his life and where he is in that area by himself and in the privacy of his own home. It for him, something happened 5 times in 50 years. It didn't happen every day.
Wait, you think he only did this 5 times?
I'm just saying there's 5 documented cases.
Oh, yeah, but you know that there's probably 20 more.
I don't know anything.
But there certainly could be.
And there could not be.
Oh my. Okay. I think that's a serial. When you do that, that's a serial kind of a thing. Even if you do it 5 times or 15 times, I feel like it's like somebody who speeds in traffic. They get caught. They get pulled over every 2,000 times, but they've been speeding for years. I mean, maybe he's only done it 5 times. I don't know. It's so frustrating. And then, of course, I love Woody Allen movies. You know, and look what he's accused of doing.
We have a president in office that's had more people accuse him than any one of these people in Hollywood, and
so
nothing
upsetting.
Happens.
It's so upsetting.
So why is there that double? Why is Al Franken? I'm not saying what Al Franken did was right. I'm just saying, why does Al Franken have to resign? Because 32 years ago, he...
No. Listen, I do think there are different, definitely variances of, and different degrees of, there's like, if you run a red light or if you drive your car through a crowd of people. I mean, there are different degrees of traffic violations. There's different degrees of sexual violations. I think that what Al Franken did was, like, it was just, it was silliness.
And I don't want to say anything, because I don't want to say that Leanne Tweeden wasn't damaged and bad things didn't happen to her from that. All I'm saying is, why is a guy in office have 40 people documented and Al Franken has one and he's...
Well, actually, Al Franken was up to 7.
Oh, he was up to 7?
When he resigned, because he said that 7, he said that's enough. But I don't think that anything he did was necessarily wrong, because to me that was all in silliness and jest anyway. But what Louis C.K. has done and admitted to is using his power, and it's just so violating to a woman. You know, and I'm not, like, again, I'm not talking about getting your ass grabbed. I'm talking about somebody whipping out his, you know, and then doing that. It's just so degrading.
I can't even do it when there's darkness in my room with the music on the right way.
I think I've only been with one or two guys in my life that I've even felt like I don't even want to see that.
I mean, I don't even know what I think to myself about it, and it's just like, it's a tough subject, but I don't know how it's going to end or where it's going to end. I don't know if more men are going to come out because I think you think about this, and one of the unspoken things about this, especially with Louis. There's only one job that I know of in the world where you go into the workplace and you are allowed to be sexually provocative and say the most difficult, uncomfortable, and rude things in your workplace.
The White House?
And it's acceptable. That's funny, the White House. No, a stand-up comedian. Right. In his workplace. He's the only person...
Or comedy writers. Comedy writers, those rooms get pretty crazy, I understand.
That's true. But when you're... I'm talking a public place where there's a lot of people.
Right.
People see a comedian say something, like somebody could pick a woman out, hey, how you doing? And say these things about her physically and what her life is and what she's like when she has sex. And crowd's laughing and he gets away with it and he doesn't go down because he has the license.
Yeah, but he wouldn't do what he did and has admitted to doing. He would not do that on stage.
That's true.
This is a whole different... Listen, I know that you know and we know how this goes down and there's different degrees, but it's just, it must be, you must feel sorry for him on some levels, because you were his friend and he is so talented, and it's sad.
I tell you why, and I hope that this comes across the right way. I don't feel sorry for him, and I'll tell you why. Because he's a brilliant man. He knows the difference between right and wrong. It's not like when you go in a parking spot and you don't put a quarter in the meter and you run into the store and you come out and there's that risk factor. Hey, you know, I think I can get away with this $50 ticket. I can go in and come out. I can beat it. And you come out and there's no ticket on the windshield. Mm-hmm. You're like, yes, I did it. But then there's a time where the ticket's there. It's like, ah. And you know what you're doing, just to a greater extent. And so for Louis and for a lot of these people, one of the things that I don't understand, and I don't know if it's a part of the psychological process of being in this kind of world that I don't know about, but I think that nobody seems to get ahead of their story. Nobody, you know, let me tell you something. I was getting calls. I get calls monthly from a major, major newspapers about a different artist every month to comment on. Every month. It's crazy. So he knows what's percolating. And so he has a chance to get ahead of the story. He's a really brilliant guy. He's got brilliant people around him, brilliant managers. And the thing that I don't understand, not just him, but every other person, why, and you tell me if you think this would have been better. Before a story comes out, you hold a press conference, or you do what's, you know how the athletes have that thing where, I forget what it's called, that website where they create the story and it goes out and they don't have to get, so he creates the press conference or the story where he says, listen, I've done some things in my career, this is what I've done in my personal life, and it's wrong, and I'm sorry, and I apologize to each one of those people, and I've decided that I'm going to resign from every one of my shows, and for the next 2 years, I'm going to dedicate my life and my career towards helping women in our business get their television shows made as writers, creators, performers. And that's all I'm going to be doing. And then I'm going to be checking into this facility. And I'm going to make sure that I'm okay and I get help so I can be the best representation of myself. I am sorry. I made mistakes. And I'm not going to wait for people to come out. I'm going to tell you now. And that's the way I'm handling my life from now on. And hopefully I can be a better person. I think that would have gone much better.
I hear what you're saying, but I have a feeling that that maybe was an option, and perhaps a lawyer said, don't do that because you're admitting guilt, or you're, you know, you might be flaming the fire before it's, you know, I'm just wondering, because that had to have occurred to him. It just makes me think that there's a reason why he didn't.
Well, the way I've known him, and I haven't been, you know, I haven't hung out with him or been that way with him for many, many years. But again, you say you don't change as a person. He was always the kind of guy who was incredibly, like, he knew what he wanted and he knew the message that he wanted. And in terms of his creations, he was the first guy I knew that had one of those little beige box Mac things.
I had that, yeah.
I mean, he was always about the creative process.
So he was on top. He is on top of the game. He does know what's going on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm so happy that you could talk with me today. I'm always thrilled with your stories and your wisdom. You give me a lot of inspiration. Really, I'm a huge fan of Industry Standard. I'm a huge fan of yours. Seriously, I've learned so much about your interview style and the way you listen to your guests and obviously the pre-production you put into it. I really appreciate that because you can tell that none of the people you're interviewing walk away thinking, like, that was a waste of time. Nobody thinks that. I mean, it is some quality interviews, really.
Well, I feel the same way about you. You're I'm honored that I had the chance to be with you here.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you so much.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank you so much for tuning in today. Why don't you tweet Barry over on Twitter, at Barry Katz, and let him know that you enjoyed his story. And then, of course, tweet me over there as well, at Storyworthy. And join us next week on Storyworthy for producer Sherry Salata, who spent over 20 years working with Oprah Winfrey.
I typed at a title company in the legal department. I was, at the time, a secretary. I was an assistant toy store manager. And then I worked my way up to toy store manager. Then I was a toy store supervisor. And then my big break was getting a job in the training program at 7-Eleven.
Don't miss Sherry Salata next week on Storyworthy. All right, you guys, I want to thank everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and everybody on the Wondery team. And a huge thank you to the sponsors on the show today. And when you guys check out my sponsors, you know that you are supporting me, and that is fantastic because then the sponsors pay me. So it's just like this big cyclical thing, and I appreciate each and every one of you. And one more time on behalf of the very talented Barry Katz, thank you so much, friend.
Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week. Can
thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.